This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ah, yes, it's that time of year. You know what I mean. National Bobblehead Day. It's coming up on the 7th. Since 2015, bobbleheads have had their own day on the calendar, as well as a special place in the heart of our own Karen Given.
This story begins at Fenway Park in May of 2015. After receiving my Louis Tiant bobblehead at the front gate, I ducked into the ladies' room while my fiancé stood in line for beer. When I came out, he immediately asked, "Where's your bobblehead?" I ran back into the ladies' room, but it was too late. I was only gone 60 seconds, but I'm sure it had been taken in five. The worst part was coming out empty-handed. It was less than 2 months before our wedding, but he looked at me like he wasn't quite sure he wanted to marry a woman who didn't know that you just don't leave a Louis Tiant bobblehead unattended in Fenway Park.
Come in, only one bobblehead per person, right?
Yeah.
They can't come around the back of you. They come around the back and they say, "Oh, I didn't get one."
I went back a couple of weeks later as an army of volunteers passed out 38,000 bobbleheads of then Red Sox first baseman Mike Napoli. It's a huge production. The kids are thrilled, of course, but a lot of the adults seem overly excited to receive a little plastic figurine with a wobbly head.
Bobblehead. Yeah. We got bobbleheads.
How old are you?
In 2015, the San Diego Padres were the only Major League Baseball team that didn't offer fans a bobblehead game, though roughly 600 bobbleheads of former Padres outfielder Chris DiNorfia were mysteriously dumped in a San Diego area driveway in November. Go figure. For years, the Red Sox didn't give away bobbleheads either.
And there was a long time, actually, where we felt like maybe they're not into bobbleheads, but even in Boston, we know that people love them. And if they love them, then we'll provide them.
That's Adam Grossman. He's the senior vice president of marketing for the Red Sox. And he knows that for an early season midweek game against a not so popular opponent, there's no better way to get fans into the park than a bobblehead giveaway.
The connection between the organization and the fans is so important. And something like a bobblehead, as crazy as it can be, can cement that.
The Red Sox spend months getting the facial features and tattoos and the stance on their bobbleheads just right. For the teams designing them and the fans receiving them, bobbleheads are just fun. Bobbleheads even have, get this, their own Hall of Fame.
We sort of thought of it this way. If mustard deserves its own museum, bobbleheads definitely deserve their own shrine.
That's Phil Sklar.
S-K-L-A-R. I'm the co-founder and CEO of the National Bobblehead Hall of Fame and Museum in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Sklar and his partner have accumulated thousands of bobbleheads, many from private collections. But they still go to games to acquire bobbleheads the old-fashioned way. And they know better than to leave their new acquisitions unattended in the ballpark.
Yeah, you know, we've been more on the receiving end where we're walking by and we see a bobblehead just sitting there and nobody's around and we wait a few minutes and make sure we don't want to obviously take somebody's bobblehead. But yeah, you don't want to put your bobblehead down for too long. People will see it and say, "Oh, somebody didn't want their bobblehead."
But just to confirm, you were not in the ladies' room at Fenway Park.
Nope, that wouldn't have been us. Although I think we do have one of the Tiant bobbleheads in the collection, but no, it's not yours.
Sklar declared January 7th National Bobblehead Day to publicize his Hall of Fame. But all of this, the Bobblehead Hall of Fame, the pallets of bobbleheads at the gates of Fenway Park, even the baubles of the Pope for sale outside the Vatican, none of this would have happened if not for a business deal made back in 1999.
Give you the story and hopefully I'll put everything into context.
Mario Aliotto is the executive vice president of business operations for the San Francisco Giants.
1999 was our last year at Candlestick Park, and we wanted to do a number of promotions that were somewhat retro. And I remember it, when I was a kid going to Candlestick, they didn't have bobblehead giveaways back then, but in the souvenir stand, you know, besides buying a Giants pennant or a program, or a keychain, there was always a bobblehead doll, and I had one. I've had one for a long time, and it's still at my mom's house today. And I was thinking, maybe we can have a bobblehead day, and that'll be something that many of our fans will remember.
Back in the 50s and 60s, most bobbleheads didn't look like real people. They looked like little boys with fat cheeks and big grins and hair that curled up under their baseball caps. The manufacturer would paint on the team's uniform and maybe a number on the back.
You know, when you put the number 24 in a Giants uniform, everyone knows who it is.
And that's what Alioto had in mind when he proposed baseball's first free bobblehead giveaway, a Willie Mays bobblehead that didn't necessarily look a whole lot like Willie Mays.
No, exactly. And I don't know why. It just felt like, you know, for me as a young fan, that was a special souvenir I had.
But I promised you the story of a business deal that would change the course of bobblehead history. And for that, I need to get someone else on the phone.
Alexander Global, this is Todd.
That's Todd Goldenberg, and he, well, I'll let him explain who he is.
So my name is Todd Goldenberg. I'm the national sales director. I'll back up a second. On dates, I used to tell women, I'm the national sales director for a sports marketing firm dealing with game day giveaways that help increase teams' attendance. And now I just say I sell bobblehead dolls.
Goldenberg says they'd like to celebrate their 50 millionth bobblehead, but they've lost count of how many they've produced. But back in 1999, they were just a small company trying to get their start.
It's a great story. So Malcolm Alexander, he's our founder and former president. He's retired now, kite skating around the world.
So Alexander was trying to start a business selling promotions, and he got a meeting with the San Francisco Giants, who you'll remember were trying to find a company to manufacture a promotional item that hadn't been made in 40 years.
He just basically said, what can I help you with? And they said, well, we need a bobblehead doll.
Mario Alioto was at that meeting.
I think we sent him a picture of it. I can't remember back then. But we explained what it is. It's a ceramic body with a head and bobbles. And we want, obviously, it's going to have to be Willie Mays. He's our greatest player.
And Malcolm, being very cocky and very Australian, said, yeah, sure, I'll do it. How many do you need? And then he proceeded to leave the office and find out what a bobblehead doll was. Because even though he had just sold about $250,000 worth of bobblehead dolls, he didn't know what he had sold. Isn't that great?
But because Malcolm Alexander didn't know he could get away with making a bobblehead that looked like a little boy, he made one that looked like Willie Mays, sort of.
To this day, Willie still tells me, that didn't look like me.
Goldenberg says all the athletes say that. And to be fair, this bobblehead didn't look exactly like Willie Mays. In fact, it's no better a likeness than a 1962 Mays bobblehead you can find on eBay. But it looked a little like Willie Mays, and it was free. Fans went crazy for it. By the next year, 8 major league teams had scheduled bobblehead giveaways. A new industry was born. Since 1999, many have predicted the end of that industry, including bobblehead salesman Todd Goldenberg. I found an interview with you in 2006 that you said, you know, bobbleheads were on their way out and these 12-scale figurines were going to be the next king of giveaways. And that didn't exactly happen. So I'm wondering if, in hindsight, you have a sense of why.
Yeah, I'd rather not talk about that. I can answer that, which is the 12-scale figurines are a great product that was more realistic than a bobblehead. But they weren't as whimsical.
And it's whimsy, Goldenberg says, that has sustained bobbleheads all these years. Now, when teams ask him what's new and exciting, Goldenberg always gives the same answer.
Nothing's new and exciting, just buy the bobbleheads. It seems like every year, year and a half, I sit down and go, all right, what am I going to do next? And it's just the bobbleheads keep going strong. This year was the most bobbleheads, the most business I've ever had this year, 15 years in. Last year was the second highest year. I'm sure someday this will slow down, but it hasn't yet.
And although Giants VP Mario Alioto wasn't trying to start something new with that 1999 Willie Mays bobblehead, he'd never agree with my calling it a mistake.
We're very proud of it. And now that I know we have a National Bobblehead Day, I know on January 7th I'm gonna have to do something special that day.
Oh, and just in case you were worried, our summer intern managed to snag me a replacement Louis Tiant bobblehead, and the wedding went off without a hitch. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
I have no use for snow, alas, for I no longer ski, and ice is likewise fun for others, but it's not for me, and yet each time this time of year rolls in like pouring sleet, it feels, I must acknowledge, like it's something nearing neat. Sports seasons are not seasonal, they overlap, I know, but still each new year promises that somebody will go and dazzle us with some performance never seen before, or seen so seldom that we're good with seeing it once more. Sometimes it is a goalie making supernatural saves, a hitter slugging homer smiling broadly as he waves and runs around the bases, sure he's reached the very top of his profession and that all the cheers will never stop. Perhaps it is a comeback that we never thought we'd see, or maybe it's a golf ball bouncing off a helpful tree, colliding with a rock, a squirrel, a donkey, or a mole, and landing with a loud kerplunk precisely in the hole. Perhaps a team that hasn't won, as long as heaven knows, will earn a big parade, and as the celebrating goes on day and night to end the dreary decades full of flubs, ah no, forget it, that one's happened, that would be the Cubs. It could be that an owner, lately arrogant and rich, decides it's time to change his ways quite suddenly and switch from calling for tax subsidies and public cash as well to paying for the stadium he wants. Ah, who can tell? The great thing about starting fresh, or seeming to at least, is that we can pretend as hopes rise up like baking yeast that each new year's not only new but full of promise, too, and hope that every we and they and me as well as you can still be filled with wonder at a moment or an act that baffles us like fiction even though it is a fact. Hooray, say I, for 17. Who knows what it will bring? Not knowing is the point, the very essence of the thing that's bound to keep us watching as we have in other years through smiles and laughter, groans, applause, and sometimes even tears. I'd like to thank Mass Rocks, who left this review of our podcast. A sharp and engaging host coupled with smart and funny commentators. What else could I ask for? Well, Mass Rocks, how about great stories set in sports? We have those, too, as it turns out. Consider a review of your own on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners to find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. Once upon a time, well, it was just back in February, I sat right here and talked about a happy ending for a story involving a 5-year-old boy named Murtaza Ahmadi. He'd cried because his family couldn't buy him a soccer jersey with the name and number of his favorite player, Lionel Messi, who happens to be my favorite player as well. Murtaza's older brother made him a Lionel Messi shirt out of a plastic bag, and Murtaza stopped crying. And then, when Messi and UNICEF saw a picture of the plastic bag jersey, they sent a few real jerseys and lots of other stuff to Murtaza and his family. A few months later, the little boy and his family were forced to leave their home in Afghanistan after being threatened by the Taliban. But there was a happy ending. Murtaza was flown to Doha, Qatar, where Barca was playing a friendly on December 13th. Murtaza was greeted by his hero and, for a time, refused to leave Messi's side. The two friends had finally met. There are places in this world where games aren't just games, and athletes have the power to be more than just pixels on a television screen. Another one of those places is just across the Pakistani border from Afghanistan in Waziristan. That's where Maria Torpakai grew up. Her sport is squash. As a youngster, her hero was Jonathan Power, a Canadian who, in 1999, became the first North American squash player to be ranked number one in the world. Maria Torpakai tells her story in her own words.
If I didn't have squash, still I would say, my father is a brave man. I'm his daughter. I'm strong. I have faith in Allah. And I'm a good human being. And when you are a good human being, everything happens good to you. You know, when I was 2 years old, I could see the happiness in boys' faces and more glow. But most of the women are just no one, you know. They are just like shadows. And from young age, they are told to cover themselves and not to go anywhere and just stay home, look after their younger brothers or siblings. You're going to get married, you know, you have to learn all those things. I thought, you know, maybe it's the difference is because boys have different clothes than girls. So then I took all my girly dresses and I took it to the backyard and I burned them when I was 4 and a half. It just felt so much freedom after burning those clothes. I was standing there by the fire in my older brother's clothes. Well, I saw my father and he didn't say anything. But when I looked at him, he just smiled and he said, "Well, I have a fifth son now." He called me Genghis Khan, which is like Genghis Khan, the greatest warrior. I was always very strong and I thought that no one is stronger than me. Sometimes when I hear some other guy's reputation very strong, I would go by the fields, by the mountains to another village and find that guy and, you know, challenge him. And whether they were, you know, playing soccer or cricket or, you know, marbles or flying kites or wrestling, I just pushed the guys and got my spot in the middle of sports. I had nowhere to go, you know, when I am 12 years old, and my father was really, really worried about my future. What am I going to do with this child? She's very aggressive and she wants to live just like boys do. But, you know, I'm growing up, and I'm a girl, I should stay home. One day he found me in the middle of a huge fight with some guy and he hit me with a brick on my head. And my dad dragged me home and I got, you know, 12, 13 stitches. My father was deep in thinking what to do with this kid. And then he realized that people play sports in Peshawar. He took me to the sports stadium next day and there was a guy sitting on a chair. My father was like, he said, I want to introduce my son into some sport. And he said, well, he looks very strong and I can train him for weightlifting. You know, it would be really good. I trained really hard and I became really strong and I got into more fights after that because I thought I'm more stronger now. I went to a national championship, weightlifting championship, and I won that with the name of Genghis Khan again because nobody knew that I was a girl and I didn't look like one. After that, when I come back, I can just keep lifting the weights, but I don't see further competitions and I want a challenge. When I saw squash, I thought that's my next challenge and I really wanted to play that sport because it was beautiful glass court. You dive and you jump. So I just loved the idea. When I told my dad I want to play squash, he was really happy with my decision because he thought, you know, now I'm going to hit the wall rather than hitting people. There is a proper squash academy and he took me there. And he asked what we should do for squash. And, you know, my son wants to play squash. Director Squash Academy, he said, definitely, we will give membership to this kid. You have to bring the birth certificate first. My father got a little nervous. And then he told him that, well, actually, this is my daughter. And her name is Maria Turpekai. That guy just stared at me in amazement. First thing, he just couldn't believe that I'm a girl. And then second, he was so happy that, you know, finally a girl is coming to play sports. And especially being from tribal region, this was exceptional. This was an exceptional thing. Right away, he gave me a gift, a squash racket, Jonathan Power Signature Series. Everything changes when the people came to know about me, I'm a girl. All the boys, they used to bully me, men and kids, everyone, and the shopkeepers that I used to go and bring groceries from them. Now I'm unable to do anything, and just they're trying their best to harass you, like, you know, in a very inappropriate way, too. So I thought, you know, what has changed? I'm still the same person. You call me Genghis Khan, you call me Maria, I'm the same person. What has changed? First thing, I'm strange. Second, looking like a boy is un-Islamic. You know, when you pretend to be a boy, is also un-Islamic. When you have short hair, this is un-Islamic. When you not cover your head, this is un-Islamic. When you play sports, this is un-Islamic. I'm like, what should I do? Like, that's the only place I had left. I didn't know where to go. When I first started squash, it was really good competition. But then when they heard about me, I'm a girl, some boys would come stand by the squash court and, you know, do some like inappropriate gestures. When I started beating them in a match, they would all the guys would laugh at that guy and he would never play with me again. So I just felt, not to play with any boy and just hit by myself. I was entered into a under-13 junior championship. I had short hair. I'm like really strong and big kid, and everybody's just staring at me, and you know, and the meetings and looking at me, and then they were like, "She's a girl or not? She doesn't look like a girl." And then I said, "Well, if you think I am, you know, I shouldn't play in girls, then I will play in boys, and I'll beat them." But then finally they provided the birth certificate, and I played under 13 event, and I won that championship, the first one. And every time I win a match, the girl would go outside the squash court and cry so much and say, "You guys made me play with a boy." I got really good in squash. I used to play for 9-10 hours a day, and even my arms were bruised, but I just kept playing for hours and hours and creating my own squash drills because I didn't have any partner to train with. There was kind of fire that I don't want to lose to anyone, and I want to show them I want to win that, you know, championship. And I was under 14 that I became national champion. When I turned pro in 2007, you know, I performed really well on international like tournament with the senior players. You know, I came to the quarterfinal of a big tournament in Egypt. When I was given awards by the prime minister, all of a sudden, and all those things all over news. So that was the time, also the peak time for Talibanization, when you hear a lot of bomb blasting, killing, kidnapping, just every day. And I have seen it with my own eyes, you know, people dying, and being a Pashtun girl, being a daughter of Waziristan, coming from their own tribe, as Talibans are, I got the threat from Taliban. My family was threatened to death. It was another tough time for me. I didn't know what to do now. For a while, I didn't play squash, and then I would thank the Pakistani government at that time who provided me undercover security around my home all the way to the squash court. But I thought it's very dangerous. I don't want to be the reason for the innocent kids to die. That's why I just decided that I'm not going to play squash. It was heartbreaking for me, and then I see all the girls playing, performing, and I'm the one who has also really good skills and really good, but cannot just compete and cannot do anything. I knew that, you know, I'm not going to give up, and when you don't give up, then the nature has to listen to you. The nature, some people say God, some people say energy, that had to listen to me. I couldn't stop. I just had a racket and ball in my hand and, you know, kept hitting by the wall of my room. For 3.5 years, I just kept doing it. And my father, he could see my suffering, and he could see my passion. He just told me that, you know, if I want to play squash, I have to leave this country. I kept emailing to every club, to every academy, to every school, college, wherever I can find, you know, offering them my service as a part-time coach, but also I'm asking them to give me time so I can train myself and play tournaments. After 3.5 years, I got a message from one person, and that was Jonathan Power. He was the one who came to me, who helped me in the toughest time of my life. That day, I believed that it's a destiny from God, because my first squash racket was Jonathan Power Signature Series. And then after 9-10 years, that's the man who comes to give me a hand of help, you know. It made my faith more stronger that I'm in the right path. I'm not the one who is dishonorable. I'm not the one who has done anything shameful. It was written for me, and I think it's a destiny. It's from Allah. Today, I tell all those people who think that I have done anything un-Islamic, if anyone have any questions, go and ask God, not me.
Maria Torpakai lives in Canada and trains at the Power Squash Academy. Her book is called A Different Kind of Daughter. Our story was produced by Karen Given. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR. Anybody can walk through Hyde Park. You don't need a ticket to do it. Even when the Olympics are going on in London, which they were in the summer of 2012, the last time I was in Hyde Park, you can walk around as if the Olympics weren't there. Set in the vastness of Hyde Park, there is a body of water called the Serpentine. It's 40 acres of recreational lake. 40 acres. I looked it up. I didn't know it was that big when my wife and I came upon it on a hot, windless August afternoon. We had seen gymnastics, we would see basketball, but we didn't have tickets to see anything that day, so we were in Hyde Park, and so were a lot of other people. They were lining the banks of the Serpentine, except for the ones who were walking across a bridge, which might have been the bridge that marks the boundary between Hyde Park and Kensington Gardens. Or maybe not. It wasn't the only bridge. But it was the one my wife and I stopped on because we noticed that there were people swimming in the Serpentine. There were also people in boats. Apparently their job was to keep the geese away from the swimmers. It looked like a competition, which is because it was. It was the Women's Marathon Swim. And the course was marked by bright inflatable buoys around which women from Spain, Italy, Germany, France, and Great Britain were churning. Women from Mexico, the Czech Republic, and the U.S. were doing that too. We watched them until a police officer told us we couldn't stop on the bridge. "You mean we have to have tickets?" my wife asked. "No," said the officer. "You just can't stop on the bridge." We went back the way we'd come, turned left at the end of the bridge, and found a spot on the bank of the lake where we could continue to watch the women swim. On the far shore, across the expanse of the Serpentine, at what may have been the finish line, there was a grandstand. It was full of people who probably had tickets. When I was a kid, people selling baseball programs used to shout, "You can't tell the players without a scorecard." And that was before the players' names were on the backs of their jerseys. That day, we couldn't have told the players even if we'd had a scorecard. They were mostly underwater. But that wasn't the point. "No tickets," my wife said. "Right," I said. At one point, we left the bank of the lake and walked to a booth where a man was selling ice cream. And when we returned to the bank, the women were still swimming long laps around the buoys. We hadn't missed a thing. As anyone who has ever gone to the Olympics knows, we had paid a lot of money for the tickets to the gymnastics and the basketball competitions. You would recognize the names of a lot of the winners of those competitions if I mentioned them here. Maybe that's why the tickets were so expensive. You probably don't recognize the name of Eva Reztoff, the Hungarian woman who won the marathon swim in the Serpentine that afternoon. Haley Anderson, an American, got the silver medal. She was 4/100ths of a second behind Miss Reztoff, which may have broken Miss Anderson's heart since she and Eva Reztoff had both been swimming for nearly 2 hours when that happened. The fourth place finisher missed a medal by a fraction of a second. On the evening of that day in Hyde Park, I had no idea who had won. I didn't know until I looked it up much later. And before that afternoon, I hadn't even known the Olympics included a marathon swim in a lake. All I knew was that my wife and I had watched the Olympics for free in the park. I felt as if I'd put something over on the corporate sponsors. When people ask about our trip to London, my wife and I talk about the gymnasts we saw and the two basketball games, one of which included LeBron James, and that was all great. But the story we most enjoy telling is the one about the event we saw for free, without intending to do it, by walking into Hyde Park. Ahead on Only a Game, Kobe Bryant has referred to his former high school English teacher as his muse.
He didn't call me a muse when he was in high school, you know, but we had a good relationship.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce returns for a look at the week's news, or maybe even 2 weeks' worth of news. But first, parenting is about choices, and not all of those choices are easy. For the parents of a promising athlete, the kind with college scholarship hopes and Olympic dreams, those decisions can become even more difficult. In March, Kate Buehler and her 14-year-old son, Christoph, brought us the story of one such choice in their own words.
There was something about Christoph. Ever since he was a baby, no crib could hold him, no high chair could hold him. He was climbing the top of street signs when he was two. So, I mean, he still had his diaper on and he would do monkey bars. So we just put a helmet on him and let him do whatever. As soon as he was old enough, he wanted to do gymnastics. It was the only thing he ever wanted to do.
I enjoyed the adventure, the feeling you get when you learn something that was completely foreign to you and where you conquer your own fear.
The gymnasts, they walk around on their hands a lot, especially when they're young, up and down stairs and around on their hands. And his first gymnastics class, there were about 20 boys. All of a sudden, all 20 of them, you know, we had 40 legs up in the air. And my husband and I said, look, he's found his people.
You're doing all these flips and twists, and it's very exciting. It's very brash, and it's this huge rush of adrenaline. And while you're doing it, everything feels sharper and more into focus. The people who are really good at it never quit, because you never want to stop feeling that. Around the age of 10, that was when I really became competitive. I would go to the gym 5 days a week for 4 to 5 hours a day.
And really, by the time he was on the Future Star team, which is the national team, he was going 6 days a week. So it came out to be about 30 hours in total commitment for both him and also for his dad driving him back and forth.
Homework was never really a problem, because with gymnastics there, I always felt pressured to do everything as soon as I possibly could.
He always had dark circles under his eyes, and he sacrificed a ton in sleep. He actually had an eye issue we didn't even notice. They said, does he get all F's in school? Because that's a typical sign. And I said, no, he gets all A's in school. So he's just a driven kid. I think that as a parent, it's easy to get sucked in. You're watching your kid win bigger and bigger competitions. You know, he was first in state several times and first in New England, and the meets, you started traveling farther and farther away until you get to California. And it's exciting, and you're proud, as you should be, right? Every parent's proud of their kid. But as he got older, he also got taller. It's sort of like being a supermodel or a basketball player. You have to have a very specific body type for certain sports. And gymnastics, he started to grow out of. And while he grew out of it, then the injuries started.
First, it was minor things. My ankle would be hurting, or a joint would be hurting me. But then I got gymnast wrist, which is when your wrist bones start stress fracturing and the fractures fall into your growth plate.
The doctor said, if they break anymore, one bone in your wrist will keep growing and the other one won't. And he said, well, can't you just saw it off? And I was like, oh, no, you can't do it. It doesn't work like that.
I fell off the high bar, one of the apparatuses, and broke my leg.
His leg was broken in three places. He worked out his arms, and he became really great at pommel horse. When his wrists were broken, both of them, he got really great at trampoline. They don't miss a day. There's kids in that gym with broken backs, broken spines.
And in between all of these big injuries, there was a bunch of little injuries. My knees, my ankles again, my back. Well, I knew it wasn't normal. Like, I'd be at school, and eventually they just stopped being surprised when I got new injuries. But I didn't really care that it wasn't normal.
You know, one of the things that you hear from every athlete or movie star when they get some award, they say, my parents believed in me when no one else did. And you want to be that parent that believes in your kid when no one else does. But of course, you know, you're seeing the success story. You're not seeing the other 99,000 people whose parents also believed in them. Finally, he got to the point where he was in a lot of pain. He was working out hard, which compacts the spine and keeps him short and keeps him from developing fully. And there was a part of me that thought, even if he wins the Olympics, even if he gets a full college scholarship, it still won't be worth it. Mentally, I was done when he fell on his head. He was on top of the high bar. It's 12 feet in the air. He was doing a handstand, and all of a sudden, he just sort of collapsed, fell on his head, his back bent over his head, and he was unconscious. They couldn't bring him out.
After that, when I woke up, my vision was really blurry. It was
not focusing on colors well. Everything was darker. The first thing I did was ask for my score because I didn't even realize what had happened.
I was on a business trip in Africa at the time, and my husband called me, and it didn't come through clearly on the phone call, so it was like, head injury, fell off the high bar, unconscious. And I said, okay, all right, is he dead? He said, no. I said, call me back from a landline. So he called me back, and I said, I'm 30 hours by plane away. I'll come home. And he said, don't bother. He can't read. He can't look at television. He can't do anything but sit there. I was done then. But he went on another year. For that year, he really couldn't do math. It was a level 4 concussion. It was very heavy.
It was, like, humiliating because I was always good at math. I didn't really like it, but it was really easy for me. And then I had to actually work for it and get help for it, and that was new.
The thing that really did it was we were in Switzerland. We went to the Olympics Museum, and he was doing handstands, you know, next to some monument, and it hurt him just to do a simple handstand. The thing that he used to do, he can walk the length of a football field on his hands, but just standing there for a few seconds hurt. He went back to Children's Hospital. You could see on the x-ray he had splinters of bone in between his wrists. And I said, I'm calling it. I looked at the doctor hoping they'd call it, but they said, no, that's not our job. Unfortunately, it was the parents' job, right? So I called it then, and I said, you're just outgrowing the sport. You're a great athlete, and he is, but this sport's not for you right now.
I understood what had to happen. I knew that gymnastics was killing me and that as much as I loved it, it was going to eventually destroy my body.
For the child, it's all they know. 30 hours a week with the same 8 boys that he's gotten to be friends with, that was his family. He spent more time in the gym than he spent with his family. So you're not just asking him to give up a sport. You're asking him to give up everything he's known, really from age 6 until 13. As a mom, you have to make some calls that they won't make, right? Because he would never have quit. He'd still be doing it. Actually, gymnastics was taking up a huge space in our life, in our family's life. And now it's kind of made way. It's been difficult at first, but it's kind of made way for other things. So it's really been eye-opening this last year. He's kind of discovering who he is again. I don't know if he ever said I was right. He knows that I love him and I would do anything for him, including let him do gymnastics if that was the right thing. But in the end, what a child athlete is missing is perspective.
I don't know that she was right. I mean, there are times when I'm still a little bitter over it. I think that it wasn't right, but it was what I needed.
We might have still been too late. You know, he probably will still have joint pains. But still, you second-guess yourself all the time. That's what parenting is, right? There's no black and white.
Kate and Christoph Buehler live south of Boston, where Christoph is now swimming, wrestling, and playing rugby. Their story was produced by Karen Given. Dear Basketball, from the moment I started rolling my dad's tube socks and shooting imaginary game-winning shots, I fell in love with you. Kobe Bryant's words from the poem with which he announced that the 2015-2016 NBA season would be his last. Gene Mastriano, what do you think? B? B minus?
I would walk away from grading this kind of a piece.
Ah.
I would definitely put it back in the lap of the writer and just ask about investment, ask about purpose. What were you going after? And I think he did the job.
Now, Mrs. Mastriano, we should explain why your opinion counts. You were Kobe Bryant's 10th grade English teacher, and then you had him again in 12th grade, right?
Oh, you've done some research.
Yeah,
speaking
absolutely.
Arts, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
We did a lot of writing in 10th grade. A lot of free writes, a lot of writer's notebook free writes, just getting the words out, the good words, the bad words too, you know?
Were you surprised when Kobe Bryant referred to you as his muse in a pregame press conference last week?
Yeah, it was the first time I'd ever been indirectly called a demigoddess, right? A muse, one of the nine sister goddesses of inspiration, right? Yeah, he wasn't even called me a muse when he was in high school, you know, but we had a good relationship. He was remarkably disciplined in high school. He was getting pulled out to play with this team or that team, and he'd be gone for days, and he'd come back with the assignments in hand. That was super. I respected him a lot for that.
There has been some debate, of course, about whether Kobe Bryant really wrote Dear Basketball. I am in the camp that says it's pure Kobe. What do you think?
I would second that. I don't know either. It took me completely by surprise. There's too strong a sense of through line, you know?
Through line?
Like just a sense of, I have a purpose, get out of my way, I'm taking this down court, and I'm getting it done, you know? As a high school student, particularly as a sophomore, I'd give them assignments, obviously, to try this type of poetry, try this type of meter, move from feverish to meter, and he would always write about basketball. He'd always talk about being a pro ball player. And again, knowing what I know and what I knew in my defense, you know, how many people can do that? So I guess I'm just trying to talk him in off that ledge. It's like, come on, how realistic can it be? I know you have this passion, but why don't you develop some sort of backup interest, you know, just in case? Silly me.
Well, I think it's fantastic that you and Kobe Bryant have maintained this relationship as his basketball career has played out, and I'm curious about whether you have a favorite Kobe story.
When he made a very generous donation to the school and we were dedicating the new gymnasium, he came in. This could be lengthy, Bill. I don't know if...
Not a problem, really.
Okay. So he's coming in, and the previous year was the last year that the Lakers were in NBA Finals. My husband and I were watching, and it was, I don't know, game three, game four. I think it was the Celtics. I'm not sure. But it was an amazingly intense game. They all the people on that court played full out. And the Lakers lost by, like, I don't know, 2 points. It was back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And I turned to my husband. I just said, oh, you know what's a shame? It's so beautiful. This was such a beautiful battle. And it's all about the struggle. It doesn't matter. And I just ranted about how beautiful it was. And what a shame it was that one half of the men on that court were going to go home absolutely devastated. And I said, I don't know how the Lakers get it together to go in for the next game. They just left everything there. And my husband just listened to me, and he just said, well, you should tell him that. I said, well, Kobe has plenty of people around him to tell him that. And he said, well, he doesn't have you. And I was like, no, I'm not going to bother him. So we go to bed. So 3 a.m., I come down the stairs, punch in this phone number, which always goes to a voicemail. I never get any sort of response, but just every once in a while I'll call about some silly thing or other. And I punch this number, and I get this machine, and I just went off about the struggle and the beauty of it and how beautiful it all was and how wonderful it all was. And I just went on and on and on. And at the end of it, I went, by the way, this is Mrs. Mastriano. And hung up. And I didn't hear a thing. And then they went on. The Lakers went on, and they went on to beat the team that they were playing. It was the Celtics. And he was coming in. And there's always a lot of press when he's arriving in town. And I got an email at school saying, how does Downer was Kobe's coach. How does Downer feel about you talking to him, giving him advice during the finals? And I wrote back, what? I didn't talk to him. He sent me a link to an ESPN article about this, and there it was in print. Yeah, I talked a lot with her through the finals. It's like, what? So January comes, right? And he asked me to speak at this dedication of the gym. So we were gathering in this little ante room, and it was just, we were sitting quietly in the room. And I just brought this article up, and he said, yeah, well, do you remember when you called me during the finals? And I said, yes, but the article says we talked. Conversation implies that one person speaks and the other person responds. And he laughed, and he said, well, I'll tell you. I saved that message, and I played it over and over and over again as I was getting ready for the rest of the games.
Wow, that is stunning.
It's a long story. I'm sorry.
Never apologize to a radio host about having to tell a long story.
Did you get a good cup of coffee while you were here?
No, I was riveted. I was absolutely riveted. Have any of the rest of your students gotten back to you and said, hey, can you kind of push my poem? Is it something you could do for me? I'd like to get published.
I hear back from a lot of students who are doing remarkably different things. It's all them. It is that person's journey. What is it? Is that a poetry no-no to use the word journey along with heart and love or whatever they are? I thought those words are very powerful. When they come from somebody who's speaking authentically, they're very powerful. Mm. And the students that come through this room have their own journey to carve, and they don't need any steam from me. They have enough of it in themselves. It's neat to watch.
Well, I'm sure you've done a great deal more than watch. Even in the brief conversation that we've had, it sounds like you're a terrific teacher.
Oh, well, thanks. Appreciate that.
You're welcome. Jean Mastriano was Kobe Bryant's 10th and 12th grade English teacher at Lower Merion High School outside Philadelphia. Jean, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, Bill, it's been fun. Thanks.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Basketball Forever's tribute mix of Kobe Bryant's farewell poem, Dear Basketball.
Heroes come and go,
but legends are forever.
That's a pretty good poem, I guess, but doesn't seem to rhyme. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.